two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice.
Lemonada.
Welcome to The Bubble. I'm your host, Andy Slavitt. Today's part two of our conversation with Albert Bourla. The first part was last Wednesday. If you haven't heard it yet, you might want to do that first. And then you can listen to this or listen to them in different orders. Wednesday's show was about the immediate impact of Delta, Albert's view on how we will keep up with Delta, how the vaccine works against the existing set of circumstances, how Pfizer tries to keep up with ongoing variants, and a lot of other current issues, including does he wear a mask in the current time frame. And great interview, very timely. This interview, I bring a lot more of your questions on a variety of topics to Albert, fixate on a couple of things, kids under 12 and his thoughts for the vaccine there. Timing of vaccine approval with the FDA, how people with compromised immune systems fare in this environment. We talked a little bit about that in the last show. How he makes decisions about where to send vaccines around the globe. Fascinating. Not too many people have as much power as Pfizer does right now, producing upwards of 3 billion vaccines in the next 18 months or so. And really having the decision in his hands, Albert does, to decide which countries to send many of those vaccines to. Now, a lot of countries like the U.S. and the G7 and G20 have a lot to say about that, and they are indeed raising their influence. But, of course, Pfizer can contract with anybody it wants to for its manufacturing capacity. And indeed, it has spare capacity right now and is making those decisions. So that's fascinating. And then we finish up with a personal story of the day that Albert got the news of the effectiveness of the Pfizer vaccine. I thought it was very fascinating, so stay till the end. Before we get there, how are we doing? Well, I would say that the outlook is cloudy with a chance of sun. A lot of what I would call muddledness right now, people are feeling, and with good reason. Masks. Do they wear them? Do they not? Should they? How important? And by the way, which type of mask? Something we don't talk enough about. Schools. What to do with the kids under 12, what to do in areas where there are no mask mandates, what to do with kids who aren't vaccinated, kids in general. We're seeing what's happening at summer camp. Are they infectious? Are they in danger? Boosters. Will we need them, and for whom, and when, and does it depend on when we got vaccinated? Travel. Should we? Shouldn't we? What's safe and what's not? Look, all of this is a result of some changing circumstances. Those changing circumstances include the Delta variant, which I think science is now shows that instead of a 15-minute exposure, COVID can now be transmitted in about 5 minutes or even less for people who are unvaccinated. Lower vaccination levels in certain parts of the country, which combined with Delta creates higher prevalence, and the presence of some breakthrough cases and a decent number of breakthrough cases, even though small relative to the number of people who are vaccinated. And while almost entirely moderate cases, still, I think we're learning, can be a source of infection. So those things tend to jumble up, the things I just talked about, masks, schools, boosters, travel. Before the school season starts, I promise we're going to dedicate an entire episode to schools and kids and those topics, and we will take your questions. So I promise you that. These other topics we've been covering as best we can with Albert and with others. We have taken kind of a two-week digression from the programming we put in place, which is covering the range of topics that I promised you we would cover, to really focus on Delta and to focus on the present. And we've done that with some scientific people like Eric Topol and Scott Gottlieb. We've brought forward these conversations with Albert Bourla, who I think will be great. And at your request, we're also inviting the CEOs of Moderna, and we'll even put an invitation out to Johnson & Johnson, making sure that all points of view come into you. And I think that'll help you with the muddledness. You know, how do I react to the muddledness as someone who is vaccinated? With more care. I'm thrilled to be vaccinated. I feel pretty safe. But, you know, I'm going to spend less time lingering indoors in restaurants than I would have, say, in May or in June. So if we want a good fall and a good winter, let's prepare for it now. And preparing for it now means doubling down on many of our efforts to get vaccinated, to control the spread, and to take the steps to keep people safe. And, you know, we will await the news that finally comes to us on boosters. Okay, let us now get directly to the second half of my conversation with the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla. So let's talk about some near-term things that are important to people. And obviously, a lot of these things are dependent upon the regulatory authorities. But probably the number one question that I got asked was, how close are we to being able to vaccinate children under 12? And I know that you again, are dependent upon the FDA process. But could you give people just a sense, and maybe a sense of what we're learning from the trials about dosing and effectiveness and safety and what your feelings are?
My feelings is that the vaccines will be very effective in children between 5 and 11, all the way to 12 years old, in lesser doses, actually, in smaller doses. And they will be also safe. But the studies are ongoing, so we are waiting to finalize them so that we can properly analyze all the data and then submit them again. I believe that we should be ready after summer to submit.
After summer, that'd be great. I know that a lot of people will be relieved to hear that. And how about when you think about cancer patients, people with HIV, others who have compromised immune systems for some reason, is there a strategy for them? Is there something that you recommend or that Pfizer's working on that addresses the concerns that those folks have, obviously, about making sure they feel protected?
In our studies of the 46,000 patients, in collaboration and under the also guidance of the FDA, we did have a lot of people that they were either immunocompromised with HIV, with other diseases, cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And we analyzed this subdata, and the vaccine was very good even with them. It's likely that the immune responses to those people could wane faster. This is something that scientifically, theoretically, you should expect. So a special care for them should be taken. This is why a lot of authorities in the world already started giving third dose, even before approval, by taking themselves the decision, a third dose into this type of people.
Yep. And recently, someone from the CDC has indicated that that's likely going to be the case here in the U.S., that they're going to try to consider moving quickly on boosts. This wasn't a definitive statement, but, you know, in my own conversations, my own read from talking to the administration, well, first of all, let me just say that the administration, the government has purchased enough boosts for everybody in the country. So that's not a concern. Secondly, as you just said, Albert, the vaccines that are being produced look exactly like the ones that are already being produced. So the same ones as soon as they're authorized that are sitting there in CVS and Walmart and in doctor's offices, you don't need anything different. And that certainly simplifies things. And I think that my sense of the expectation of the administration is that after that, the FDA and CDC will do their job, they'll do a review. But in fact, that particularly easiest to say with certain subgroups, that it's very likely we're going to see a recommendation that come later this summer or the fall that indeed, as you say, boosters are given. Obviously, we'll wait for the approvals for that. But that seems to be where things are heading, at least is my read as well.
I think we need to give the time to the CDC, to the FDA, to see the data, absorb them. Of course, they move very fast themselves because they understand that time is life here. But it's important for them to feel very comfortable scientifically. And it's important also for the public to see that they take their time, they do all the diligence, and then they provide approval, and then they provide the recommendations. What we are doing to make sure that we expedite this, we started sharing already all our data with them. So we don't wait until the final submission, that will be the official submission. We give them a preview of the data that they are coming, so they have this very important information in their hands as they are designing healthcare policies.
Yeah, and I would add that at least in this administration, it's sacrosanct that the White House does not interfere with the CDC and the FDA when they review the data and make these decisions. You know, people often confuse, maybe given the prior administration or other reasons, hey, why doesn't the Biden administration do X and Y and Z with the boosts with the vaccines? And I think it's the same reason you said, which is giving them time to analyze the data, get it right, and that the public needs to rely on that. Speaking of FDA approval, I think there's a lot of people very eager for the BLA to get finalized. First of all, there are people who probably have not been vaccinated because they're under some understanding that in an emergency use authorization, somehow the vaccine is less safe than it would be under a BLA. Whether they're right or wrong, that's certainly a perception that's out there. There are also a number of businesses and others who are ready to respond and react. Here, too, you've been submitting lots and lots of data. And of course, the FDA has been with you since the start of this process over a year ago. So without asking you the question that everybody wants to know, which is, hey, what's taking them so long? What are they working on? How do you read their diligence and their progress?
I think they are doing very good diligence. So they are going deep into everything. They have asked us a ton of questions. We clarified everything. So it's very obvious to us that they are digging into those data. They have given us a fast-track designation, which gave an approval expected date in January. But I know that they are doing everything they can. That's the maximum, right? It's not what they will really take. They will take as much as they think they need to do a good job. And I think that they try to move very fast. The most important thing is not that if we are analyzing data from a study of 46,000 people. This is fantastic, but in this particular case, we have data from millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, that they have used the vaccine. And that gives to regulators around the world a very high level of comfort when they speak about these vaccines. And if there was any side effect, even the most rare of them, I don't know, 5 in a million, already we've got them. We caught them, right? So there was never a vaccine in the world that by the time of its approval, regulators had so much experience and exposure to data than with this vaccine.
That's right. Well, that's certainly promising. And my own view is whether it's August or September, whatever the date is, I'm less concerned about the weeks in between than I am about making sure that when it comes out, that people can trust that the FDA did not have anybody pressuring them to shortcut the process so that indeed the public trusts what they see out of the FDA, which they will have reason to. And I think the FDA, as you and I both know, they're always either too slow or too fast for someone's taste.
Yeah.
You know, they never get it just right. But that's why they have to sometimes tune out a little bit of the criticism, and just we have to trust them to do what they think is right.
I fully agree on that.
So let's talk a little bit about the globe, if we could. By calculations I've seen have shown that among all the vaccine manufacturers, we need about 11 billion doses to vaccinate the globe, and that it will take us, given kind of our run rate of manufacturing, that it will take us into and towards the end of 2022 before we're able to do that. Is that how you kind of roughly see the picture?
I think that I can speak about ourselves because I have very high level of confidence. We made in the first 6 months $1 billion. And we will make in the second 6 months, which is July to December, $2 billion. So in total for the year, we'll make $3 billion. Next year, in 22, we will exceed the $4 billion. So in the next 18 months, we will make $6 billion, if you calculate two, starting July 1st, for this year, and four, at least, next year. I think, hopefully, we will exceed that. So more than half of what the world needs, we will make it ourselves. And there is Moderna, there is J&J, there is AstraZeneca, there is Sinovac, there is a lot of vaccines that they are circulating. So I feel that the world will have enough vaccines. And actually, I feel that the world will have enough vaccines so that they can even choose which one they want, not take the one that it is available.
That's obviously a good outlook. You used the expression earlier that time is life. And of course, in the meantime, while we have shortages, there's this sense of picking and choosing how we distribute these vaccines. And, you know, some countries are fortunate, the United Kingdom, the United States, Israel, and then you have other countries, Indonesia, India, Australia, that have a more difficult outlook here. When I hear from people in those countries, both I hear from government officials and from ordinary citizens, as I'm sure you do as well, how to think about what they're facing in the next few months and how close are we to being able to meet some of these needs. And I know, as you say, Pfizer is only, can't do, and isn't doing the whole thing itself. You've got others out there. But the Pfizer vaccine to date has been the one that's had a combination of very, very high degree of success, a very high degree of scalability in manufacturing.
Yes, and I would add to the list of countries that they are facing issues with supply, low-income countries, countries in Africa, some countries in Asia of low income, and some countries in Latin America. And also I would add that the reason why the United States or UK or anybody else got the vaccine in higher quantities in the first half than other places, because in the first half we see 216 markets, countries, right? So it's not that we gave only to three. But clearly we gave way more compared to the population in those high-income countries. It was because they had ordered when we asked them to order on time. And unfortunately, many of the low- or middle-income countries, other than the Europeans, I mean, they made bets and they ordered other type of vaccines for several reasons. At the time, who knew that mRNA would be the technology to prevail? Actually, it was a counterintuitive. It was the one that we didn't have any information. Also, it was very important for them when someone could promise, we will make it locally, we will make technical transfer, we will manufacture it in your country. That was extremely important for them. So they picked those type of vaccines. Eventually, on the contrary, Europeans and Americans, they placed bets, multiple bets. They didn't want to take any chances. And they basically reserved all the capacity at the time. I personally sent letters to many leaders of those countries. I called several of them. I texted a few of them, urging them to place orders with our vaccine because the available projected capacity at the time was reserved rapidly. And I knew that we would enter a situation that people would say, why you give only to high-income countries, you don't give to low-income countries. They didn't. They were not convinced with my pledge to do it. Eventually, two things happened. One, the mRNA technology was proven to be the one. Secondly, the technical transfer was proven to be very challenging. The fact that someone is promising you, I will do in one of your local manufacturing, let's say, producers, a technical transfer, I will be able to do it in a year, you will have local manufacturing, didn't happen. Simple as that, right? And that created a very different situation in these countries. Then they remained without any any available options. This is when they came back to us. And frankly, all of them. That's why we are shipping to 116 countries right now. And the principle we were using was that we couldn't take doses out of people that they had reserved and they had made their plans on time. What we could do was to try to make more and more and more so that they would not have to choose. And this is why what we were thinking in January of this year that would be 1.3 billion doses, it became 3 billion doses for this year and 4 for next year. And we were successful on that. So in the second half, it's going to be way more doses now sent to low and middle income countries rather than to the high income countries, because this is when now they have reserved those doses. They are there,
right,
waiting for them.
Right.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
The additional $4 billion for next year, are those all purchased, or are you still figuring out how those get allocated based upon the ongoing conversations you're having with national leaders?
No, they're still under the process of allocating. There are many countries that they have reserved. For example, you just saw that the US made an additional order of 200 million doses. Europe had made a very big agreement, was the first one to secure doses for 22 and 23. Canada secured doses for 22, 23, 24. Israel secured doses for 22, 23. But And we are again with all these countries and telling them also, please reserve. Yeah. There is enough, but please reserve, because I don't know how things will eventually go. And I believe that, of course, now is very different because the technology is proven, the manufacturing reliability is proven and exists, the manufacturing capacity. So I think those doses will be allocated in a few months.
That's great. If a country came to you and said, Albert, you know, Australia, we'd like you to build a plant here for the long term. This is not for the 21, 22 issues, but for beyond that. Do you have enough technology and team and staff and scalability and capability to add additional factories in new locations over time?
Look, Andy, I want to be again straightforward. First of all, there is literally no country in the world that they didn't call me to set up manufacturing capacity in their soil. And when I say no country, literally, I mean countries in Africa, they ask me to do it. A lot of them. Countries in Latin America, they ask me to do it. Of course, Australia, everyone, right? They want to do it. And it's not possible to have a manufacturing site in every country, because then we will run into the issues that you just described. Secondly, as I said, it was proven that our strategy to focus our production in mega sites that we knew we were having very good quality control around it, compared to a strategy that we will give to contract manufacturers or will spread our production with technical transfers in around the world, was the successful one and the other didn't work. And there was a reason why. And it's not only, as you pointed out in the beginning with the strategy, that we were able to make these big quantities, but we haven't destroyed a single batch so far. We haven't lost a single batch. Everything that we produce has consistent quality. And you know the big issues that other manufacturers were running with doses that unfortunately we had, let's say, they had to dispose.
Yeah.
So I think that we don't really need to go out. Now, to your question, yes, if it was Australia, I think in Australia they have enough technical expertise with people. If we were deciding to build a manufacturing site there, I think in Australia we could easily find the highly skilled force that is needed to operate this type of facilities. I don't think that would be the same in countries that they do not have the same level of scientific sophistication.
Got it. And I want to clarify one thing, which I think I understand, but I'm not sure I have right, but I think it's a misconception in the public, which is that when you provide vaccines to poor and intermediate income countries, my understanding is that you're doing so oftentimes purchased by COVAX or by the US, but you're doing it at a very different price than you do in the developed world. And I think it'd be great for people to understand that.
Yeah, way back in July, when we established our final pricing strategy, we established a tier price. So we divided the world into three tiers. And we gave comparable prices to each tier. The first tier was the high-income countries, the US, the Europe, etc. And then it was a price that it was, you know, the cost of a meal in this country, still very reasonable price. And then you could play with if they could give high orders, etc. We could give some discounts or negotiating. But there were one tier. The middle-income countries, as defined by the World Bank definition, received half this price. Middle income, for example, it is Brazil, Argentina, this type of countries, right? South Africa, right? The low income countries and the lower level middle income countries were getting it at cost, non for profit. And in fact, some of them will get it completely for free because sponsors intervene, like the US with the Biden administration, that purchased 500 million doses from us at cost, not at the price that the US will pay for US usage, but at cost, and then they are donating them free. And by the way, these 500 million doses, once they purchased, we block them at cost, and they are part of the allocation. So now no one is moving those doses, right? They are there. As long as we stick with our production schedule, which has been proven to be very reliable, we will deliver those doses to the people that they, the U.S. government, will decide to donate those doses. And they have to be low-income countries. Our contract is clear that they cannot give it, for example, to France, right, which is high-income countries. They can only give it to low-income countries.
Right. And so I think it's important for people to know that vaccinating the poorest of the poor is not a matter of cost. It's an expensive proposition. But the wealthy countries, the G20, the U.S., and others stepping up to buy those and to buy them at cost is a big difference. It would be completely unaffordable if the world had to be vaccinated at the same price the U.S. was paying. And so that's a real important part of the perspective that I think you as a global manufacturer and research arm and the G20 undertook together to try to solve this problem.
Absolutely. You're right. And I have to say that when I said I send letters to leaders, please place your order, it was clear to them that it was going to be the cost of the order at the time was going to be at non-for-profit. It's not that we gave it at a very high price.
Right.
It was, yeah.
Let me close by talking about you, Albert, as a global communicator and the importance of communication in this time. I remember the day that we first learned of the first study which showed the efficacy of the Pfizer vaccine, the 96%. You talk about your reaction and what happened and what you felt like personally, how you learned of the news and what that meant.
It was the greatest joy of my life, and it was a phenomenal relief. Because, you know, when you have billions of people around the world and hundreds of millions of businesses around the world and hundreds of governments around the world placing all their hopes on you to be able to deliver a solution, and you are in the forefront of this effort, you know, you feel the weight. on your shoulder. So it was, I knew that the day I was expecting to hear the data, which we, it was like a black box. We didn't know what, when we unblind the data will tell us. I was very much aware of how much are at stake. So I found out it was Sunday. It was around 2 o'clock that I found out. I went together with the head of research, our legal counsel, head of communications, and my chief of staff, a very small group, into our corporate offices in Connecticut, and then some security guards. And then we were waiting to hear, to receive a text. Actually, my chief of staff, Yolanda, received the text. Every time that her phone was chiming, I was jumping from my seat. Are they ready? Are they ready? Then one of these, she said, assemble ELT. So it's the go. So we went into a room. We connected with WebEx video conference with a team of scientists, three, that they had just heard from another team, which was the Data Monitoring Committee. People may not know that in every study, you have to appoint an independent data monitoring committee. So it's a committee of independent experts, typically professors, clinicians, that they are not Pfizer. And they could have visibility in the study to make sure that they will tell you, stop the study, you have good results, or don't stop, continue. So that we never know what really is going on with the study. So they had reviewed the data, and they told these guys, our guys, we strongly recommend you to apply for emergency use authorization immediately. That is, for a data monitoring committee, that was not a typical language. They are very frugal with their words. Usually they will say, we recommend continue the study. We recommend stop the study for efficacy. We recommend stop the study because it doesn't work, futility. That's what they do say. Those were very strong words. So immediately, I felt that something was going on there. And they told us the news, and the first thing that they told us was that it's working. It was Katherine Jensen, the head of our vaccines, and then we knew. Katherine didn't know at that time the magnitude. She only knew that we have statistical significance. And why is that? Because we had processes in place so that very few people will find out the real number and then evaluate the situation in terms of what we need to do with disclosures. And those two people were only two. So after that was done, everybody left the room, and I stayed, me and the general counsel. And then we had the second connection with two biostatisticians that they knew the data. And they told me the numbers. And I thought I misheard when they told me the numbers. And then, what are you doing? I said, but what is the efficacy? And they told me 95.6%. And then I was astonished. And I felt that me and Doug, which is our legal counsel, that we are sitting in the most material information in the world at that time. That something that it is destroying the economies and is taking lives of millions, there is now suddenly a solution from zero that we didn't know anything. Now we know that we have 95.6%. So we discussed what to do. And I had discussed the previous days with Operation Warp Speed, Monsef Slaw, how to present the data once the data are known to us. And he suggested, let's not give the number. For example, let's not say it is 72% effective. Let's say it is effective. Because he said, by the time you do that, until the time you submit the data, it will take, let's say, a month. And this 72 may become 73 or 71. Let's not confuse the people with saying two numbers, because it's important. And I agreed with him, so said only if it is working. But we were expecting 60s to 70s. This was the efficacy that we were powering the studies. When we realized that we had a 95.6, my legal counsel told me, you can't sit on this information. You need to take it out. That's material information, not for the companies, for the health authorities of the world. They need to know what is coming. So then we debated for a while, and then we decided, let's say more than 90%. So let's not give the exact number, 95.6, but let's present the information that this is not what you were expecting, is way, way, way better. And this is what we did. And we went the next day with a more than 90% efficacy.
Wow. And as you said, it's easy to forget this now, but the world was expecting, hoping for vaccines that were more than 50% effective, 60, 70% effective. And it was truly a day that I think so many of us remember. And thank you for sharing that.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Since that time, I imagine you spend your time talking to world leaders, talking to the public, and the one thing that's hit people the hard way in some respects is there's one more data point that you have to keep track of before you figure out how effective the vaccine is, and that's what percentage of the people are going to take the vaccine, and that's the trust level. And as I said at the time, you know, 100% effective vaccine with a 50% acceptance level is exactly the same as a 50% effective vaccine with 100% trust level. And so this effort to get people, many of whom I think are unsure about whether or not to get vaccinated, is a monumental global task that has equal importance as the effectiveness of the vaccine in many respects. And yet it's a bit of a black box as well. And I think that, you know, for people who are vaccinated, they don't understand how people who are unvaccinated think. But I would also say what's probably true is for people who are unvaccinated, they're not sure how people who vaccinated themselves so quickly think, and that people have a process to go through. Sure, there are people who throw out misinformation and all of those things we've talked about on the show before, but there's also a process people go through before acceptance. And so for some people, it's longer than others. How do you think about the context of that very important dialogue, how it will be had, how people's concerns and misconceptions about the vaccine, their thought that it was just rushed, that the mRNA vaccine was invented last year, which a lot of people believe, and yet there's a far greater story to tell. And many people, including you and your scientists, are positioned to at least tell part of that story. How do you think about that? Because I get the sense that it's something, Albert, that you're paying attention to.
Of course I pay attention, because as you said, it is one of the most important critical success factors in our ability to defeat the virus. The more unvaccinated people we have, the more variants we will have, and then the more sickness, and it's getting complicated for all. The people that they are hesitant to take a vaccine, they are good, decent people, at large, right? They're afraid, most of them, either for the reason that you just said, maybe it's new, maybe they're acid, or because they are... They have heard misinformation campaigns that go from paranoia, like there is a microchip to monitoring you, all the way to I've heard that people are dying and they don't say it. So there's a lot of that going on. But the fundamental thing it is that they're afraid. And you know, when when you have fear, you can't, conquer your fear with rationalism, right? So I think it's extremely important, because there are different variations of gray over there, that we provide the information, we are transparent, we keep providing and providing the information. But the information, it is already out there. Hundreds of millions of people have taken it. They are perfectly fine. And those that they are taking, they are protected. But still, they are not convinced. I found that the best way to talk to those people, it is by explain to them what their decision means for others, not for them. And particularly for people that they love the most. Because they are the people that they will hug, and they will kiss, and they will see. And I have found that in humans, the only emotion that it is stronger than fear is love. So when you speak to them and say, you know, your decision is not going to affect only your health, which is your case. We are in America. We are free spirit. So you need to make your decision for your own health, including. But will affect the lives of the people that you love, your grandkids or your kids. So think about it twice before you do it. I think it's the best thing that I have found so far working. And the worst of all, it is to try to shame those people. Aren't you saying that you are doing that? The worst you can do. And by the way, unacceptable.
Yeah, and I think people shame people without even knowing they are, just with labels, and I couldn't agree more. I also think there are a set of concerns that are quite rational for someone who knows nothing about a vaccine and say, hey, this is brand new. What something happened to me in 10 years? We can look at that and say, dumb question. But these aren't dumb questions. You know, these are questions that people have and that they should be treated with respect. I do wish more people knew the full story of how long the mRNA platform has been under development, how much research has gone into it. I think there's a lot of people who don't know that. And for some people, that may be reassuring. I also hope that FDA, the final BLA, will give people the chance to say, you know what, the jury was out and I was waiting, but the jury's come back. And it's a very tough jury. There's no tougher jury than the FDA. So, you know, we're going to see that.
Yeah.
Well, Albert, I want to thank you, you know, making time for this and talking to the public when you have so many other things to do. I'm so glad you think of it as part of your role. And I think, you know, this is important. These are really great clarifications for people and thoughtful things. And, you know, my hope is that the basic belief in basic science and in funding basic science and research, that we will see and understand the benefit. And finally, thank you to your scientists. I don't know them all. I've met a couple of the leaders, but the people who work on the bench for these kinds of moments for their career, this has to be incredibly meaningful for them. And of course, we're counting on them, as you say, we're counting on them to keep us ahead of the curve going forward. So please, thank you to all of your team.
Of course I will. Thank you very much, Andy.
Thank you to Albert Bourla for sitting for that long interview and answering my questions. I hope you found it useful. The idea, as always, is to give you the chances to hear from people directly. The premise, as with Frank Luntz, as with Scott Gottlieb, as with David Axelrod, as with Facebook, is just for you to get a chance to listen to a conversation that I would be having as if I were having it not being recorded. And the goal is that you get the fresh insights, not necessarily that you believe everything you hear. I think you're all quite smart enough to be able to decide what you want to hear, what you don't want to listen to. But because I do have these conversations and people are kind enough to agree to come into my bubble, gives me a chance to record them and play them for you. And so hopefully that will be helpful to you in the decisions you make and in keeping things on track. Let me tell you about the next episodes on Wednesday. Mike Osterholm, the extraordinary public health leader who has 3 decades of experience with pandemics and thinking about pandemics and talking about pandemics. You know, Mike and I, because we were both in Minnesota for a while, know each other quite well. And so it is a really kind of intense intense, detailed, inside baseball conversation with no pretense, no formality, just a lot of back and forth questions. I just recorded it. I think it's a perfect example of just bringing it to you straight. That'll probably be an impactful episode. Then we're going to talk about a couple things. We're going to have one or more governors on to talk about local efforts at vaccination. And then we're going to have our big episode on kids and schools with probably the most one of the most popular people ever be on the show. It's not Tina Fey. It's not Tony Fauci. It's Rich Corsi. Yes, Rich Corsi is one of the most popular people to ever be on the show. And we're going to talk about kids and school intensely and answer your questions in kind of a toolkit format. So there it is. There it is. Happy Monday. And hope you have a great week. Well, I'll talk to you again on Wednesday. So hope you have a great couple days. Thanks. Thanks for listening in the bubble. Hope you rate us highly on your podcast apps. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McCohen produced the show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev and John Miller. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax are the executive producers of this show. We love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, and you can find me at aslavitt on Twitter or at andyslavitt on Instagram. If you do like what you heard today, please tell your friends, and please stay safe, share some joy. We will definitely get through this together.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, friends, it's Meghan Trainor.
And her big bro, Ryan Trainor.
And her husband, Daryl Sabara.
Each week on our podcast, Working On It, we share behind-the-scenes stories and bring you into our hilarious and heartfelt conversations, and sometimes with amazing guests.
We tackle everything from navigating Hollywood to mental health to Meghan becoming a mother, Daryl becoming a father, and so much more.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of our lives and leave no detail behind. Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
Listen to new episodes out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.